From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a great storyteller, writer Pat Conroy. He said that the central fact of his art and his life is his father's violence. Conroy presented a fictionalized version of his authoritarian and abusive father in his novel The Great Santini. In his new memoir, My Losing Season, Conroy tells the real story of his father and describes the second toughest man he ever met, the basketball coach he played for at the military college, The Citadel. Pat Conroy is also the author of The Prince of Tides, which, like The Great Santini, was adapted into a film. Pat Conroy, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Police in Montgomery County, Maryland, today said the Washington area sniper has specifically threatened children. Chief Charles Moose read the message.
It is in the form of a postscript. Your children are not safe anywhere at any time.
The warning apparently was contained at the end of a message found at the scene of Saturday night's shooting in Ashland, Virginia. A man was critically wounded as he walked to his car in a restaurant parking lot. Meanwhile, a bus driver was killed today in a sniper attack in Aspen Hill, Maryland, the same area where the shootings began October 2nd. The 35-year-old man was fatally shot as he stood in the top step of his bus. So far, that shooting has not been officially linked to the sniper, believed responsible for 12 other shootings, 9 of them fatal. For the first time, the U.S. government is prepared to release some of the men detained at Guantanamo Naval Base as possible terrorists. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld says a small number of the detainees no longer represent a threat, nor have much more to offer in the way of intelligence information. NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
There are nearly 600 men being held prisoner at the Guantanamo base in Cuba. In the past, U.S. officials have said the detainees could be held indefinitely as enemy combatants without charges being brought against them. But the governments of Pakistan, Kuwait, and some other countries have expressed concern that some of their citizens are being held at Guantanamo without good reason. Apparently, in response to those concerns, the Defense Department is preparing to release some of the detainees. If there's no need to hold them, says Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, then the goal is to not have them. None of the detainees have yet been set free, but a defense official says there will be numerous detainee releases soon. Some prisoners will be transferred to the custody of their own governments. Tom Gelton, NPR News, The Pentagon.
Six Buffalo area men accused of supporting terrorism pleaded not guilty today at their arraignment in federal court. From member station WBFO, Eileen Buckley reports.
Defense attorneys entered the pleas on behalf of each client. The indictment charges the men with one count of conspiracy and one count of providing material support to a terrorist organization. The suspects, all U.S. citizens of Yemeni descent, are accused of attending an al-Qaeda training camp in Afghanistan during the summer of 2001. Both sides will return to court November 27th. At that time, the judge could begin to schedule pretrial motions. But a trial is not expected to begin until next year. Assistant U.S. Attorney William Hochul says over the next 30 days, both sides will review a number of issues in the case. Only one defendant was granted bail but remains in custody. His attorney says they are still trying to secure properties to raise $600,000 in bail. For NPR News, I'm Eileen Buckley in Buffalo.
On Wall Street today, the Dow closed down 88 points. The Nasdaq was down 17. This is NPR News. The Federal Trade Commission has filed charges against a telemarketing company, claiming it defrauded tens of thousands of people of millions of dollars. According to the agency, the First Capital Consumers Group targeted people with poor credit histories. The FTC says the Toronto company offered a major credit card in exchange for an advance payment of about $200. No consumers ever received a card. The FTC said consumers lost more than $6 million. It's filed charges against First Capital in Chicago. The federal court issued a temporary restraining order to freeze the company's assets. Gasoline prices across the country are continuing a slow but steady rise, Bill Cohen of Ohio Public Radio reports.
The Federal Energy Department says last week the average price for a gallon of regular gas was up nearly 2 cents. Over the past month, the price increased more than 6 cents. The price hikes are something U.S. motorists haven't seen for half a year. During the spring and summer, pump prices were remarkably stable. In fact, it was the longest plateau of fuel prices in at least 6 years. Crude oil prices have risen due to growing tension between Iraq and the U.S., but that short-term price trend may be over. At one point today, crude oil prices fell to their lowest level since early September. Analysts cite as the cause speculation that the prospect of an immediate U.S.-Iraq war has dimmed. For NPR News, I'm Bill Cohen in Columbus.
President Bush went to Pennsylvania and Maine today to campaign for Republicans. He urged crowds to give him a Congress controlled by Republicans so he could advance his agenda for the nation. The president has raised money for Republicans at 66 events this year, an average of one every 4 days. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Aveda, maker of earth-sensitive hair, body, and lifestyle products, and proud supporter of NPR's environmental coverage. Information at aveda.com.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Vintage Books, publishers of the new paperback collection of stories by Alice Munro, Hateship, Friendship, Courtship, Loveship, Marriage, and by the National Endowment for the Arts.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Pat Conroy, made his father famous, but not for the traits a father would want to be famous for. In the novel The Great Santini, Conroy presented a fictionalized version of his father, a Marine Corps pilot who disciplined his wife and children with verbal abuse and violence. In the film adaptation of The Great Santini, the father was played by Robert Duvall. Conroy went to the military college, the Citadel, and wrote a fictionalized account of the harsh discipline he encountered there in his novel The Lords of Discipline. Now he's written a memoir called My Losing Season that includes the real version of some of the events he's fictionalized. It focuses on his years at the Citadel, when he played for the school's basketball team, the Bulldogs, and played for a coach who was nearly as authoritarian as his father. Here's a short reading.
Because I grew up a complete stranger to myself, I did not even seem to catch a glimpse of a determined young man who developed in secret during college. I do not recognize the intense stranger who stares back at me in photographs faded and frayed around the edges. My coaches, throughout my youth, all approved of me because my attitude was upbeat and fiery, my enthusiasm contagious, and I gave everything I had. I liked that part of me also, but had no idea where it came from. As a boy, I had constructed a shell for myself so impenetrable that I have been trying to write my way out of it for over 30 years, and even now I fear I have barely cracked its veneer. It is as rouged and polished and burnished as a specialized glass of telescopes, and it kept me hidden from the appraising eyes of the outside world long into manhood. But most of all, it kept me hidden and safe from myself. No outsider I have ever met has struck me with a strangeness I encounter when I try to discover the deepest mysteries of the boy I once was. Several times in my life I have gone crazy, and I could not even begin to tell you why. The sadness collapses me from the inside out, and I have to follow the thing through until it finishes with me. It never happened to me when I was playing basketball, because basketball was the only thing that granted me a complete and sublime congruence and oneness with the world. I found a joy unrecapturable beyond the realm of speech or language, and I lost myself in the pure, dazzling majesty of my sweet, swift game.
Pat Conroy reading from his new memoir, My Losing Season. At the Citadel, you played for a losing team. You
yes.
You write that you learned a lot from losing. What are some of the things you learned from losing?
Well, it's the thing that has always been a theory of mine that does not sit very well in America. I don't think you learn anything from winning. You know, you just jump up and down. It's wonderful. It's fabulous. It's glorious. You're happy. Your coach is happy. Your school is happy. But losing, there's a deeper music in loss. There really is something about losing that you have to figure out what you did wrong. You have to change the way you played. You have to look at yourself in a different sort of way. Losing seemed to prepare me for life. Bad reviews. My mother dying. There was nothing about my mother's death that reminded me anything about winning, but it did remind me of how I felt whenever we lost.
You're right. I never once approached greatness, but toward the end of my career, I was always in the game. That's as opposed to being always on the bench. was it difficult to accept not being great, you know, to really love something and be good at it, but to know you're never going to be great?
It seemed like reality to me. The one thing I loved about athletics was its utter justice. I went out against the court. I tried the best I could, but I was physically overmatched time and time again. There were limits to my talents that I had to find out about it, recognize, and then finally accept. And the acceptance of being mediocre was difficult, but I think it also is a great preparation for the pitfalls of life itself.
You had a coach who worked the players really hard and could be very negative when working you.
Terry, very good. I think you read him correctly.
tell us about his style.
Coach Mel Thompson was a great rebounder and player from North Carolina State. He was coached himself by the great Everett Case, who brought was with Adolph Rupp, was one of the guys that brought basketball to the South. Everett Case was famous for being tough on his players. And Mel Thompson was as tough as any man I have ever met. And he was on us from the time we began practice to the time he blew the whistle for practice to be over. He was the kind of man that was, I think, very common, certainly in my childhood, and I think certainly in the 50s and 60s, where he simply, I think in a Bobby Knight sort of way, simply screaming was an art form with him. And I think eventually the breaking of his team's heart was what he did. He did not meant to be. He just simply coached the way he was coached. And I think a lot of people did that back then.
What do you mean by the breaking of his team's hearts?
I think Coach Thompson, eventually, the boys that he broke on my team were the boys with real talent, not boys like me. And Coach Thompson, to me, was a much milder version of my father.
Mm-hmm.
Coach Thompson yelled at me all day long. He didn't hit me, so I ended up loving him.
He didn't hit you because you were used to a devil far worse in your father?
Yes. Dad was the toughest man I've ever met. Mel Thompson ranked second.
What were some of the things the coach would yell at you? What were some of the things he'd save for you?
They don't want to hear this on National Public Radio, Terry.
Give us the clean version.
Let's see. The clean version is, okay, you guys are women. Women. You guys play like women. Women. The lowest thing on earth. Women. And it was variations on that theme. You know, we were weaklings. We were cowards. We didn't want it enough. We couldn't do it. You know, did we have no manhood? Do we have no pride? There was a variation of that theme that began in October and ended in February.
You write in your book that you learned to substitute your voice for his voice so that your voice would be in your head instead of his voice.
I was afraid of Coach Thompson, and I was intimidated by Coach Thompson. So what I had to do, and I had to learn, and this was valuable for later on in my writing life, I had to listen to my voice. I had to find confidence by listening to me because I could not find it listening to him. Coach Thompson did not inspire confidence. He inspired terror. And until I could listen to myself and ignore his voice, I did not come into my own as a basketball player.
How did you learn how to block out his voice with your own?
It was in the locker room during the Loyola game, during halftime. We had the team. I was not starting, and the team had a meltdown. And Coach Thompson, who was a heroic, how should I put this? He could take you apart verbally at halftime of a basketball game better than anyone I've ever seen. He, on this night, it was mythic. He simply came apart. He was flinging chairs all over the locker room. He was screaming that our team was nothing. We didn't care. We had no pride. Played like women. Magnificent profanity. And I looked around the room and I saw my team, and they all had their heads in their hands. And I realized my team had been broken. My team had been broken not by the other team, but by their coach. So I sort of heard a voice inside me saying, "You can't listen to this guy. He's not good for you, pal." And the voice shocked me at first because my family produces schizophrenia, like some families produce freckles. But I mean, it was a voice. It was clear and it was solid. And I worried about schizophrenia except for this. The voice was giving me good advice. This was a voice I could trust. It startled me because it sounded like my father's voice. And I did not recognize it at first as my own voice, and what I later called my writer's voice, the one I listen to, the one that brings me good news, gives good advice, uses sound judgment. And it was the first time that this had ever happened because in my childhood, and look at this boyhood I lived, Terry, the great Santini, the Catholic Church, the American South, the Citadel Plebe system, and Mel Thompson. No one had a male-dominated childhood like I did that ever lived upon this planet. And until this voice appeared, I was a very docile, obedient cadet. I did not get in trouble. I was not a hood. I was not a gang member. I did not smoke dope. I did not drink. I simply towed the line of my very disciplined childhood. Until this night, I had never heard my own voice say anything.
My guest is Pat Conroy. His new memoir, My Losing Season, is about playing basketball when he was at the Citadel. Now, your team was a losing team. What holds a losing team together? I mean, what's...
Nothing.
Uh-huh.
Absolutely nothing. The reason I wrote this book is I was sitting in Books and Company in Dayton, Ohio, a city I'd never been to, nor had I ever wanted to go to. But I was sitting there at the end of a book signing, and I looked up and I saw my ex-teammate, John DeBross. And I had not seen John in 30 years, and he and I had played guard together. I looked up and I said, DeBross, you ever been in a bookstore before? He turned to me and said, once, Conroy, I was lost. And he finally said, Conroy, my wife and kids don't believe I know you. Would you come to my house and meet them? I've been telling them I've known you for all these years, and I haven't seen you in 30 years. So we were driving out into the suburbs of Dayton, Ohio, and John started talking. It was like the locker room came alive, sprang alive, and I had not thought of it for all these many years. And DeBross, who's very competitive, said, I was better than you, Conroy. I was a lot better basketball player. And I said, you certainly were, John, and you proved that every single day. And he started talking about the team and where they'd gone. I realized our team had scattered to the four winds. So none of us had kept up with each other, that we were all strangers to ourselves. We had not invited each other to our weddings, our christenings. I had no idea the names of any of my teammates' children. They did not know the names of mine. So as we were going out there, DeBross said, Conroy, do you remember the last game of your career? I said, I certainly do, John, but I would never have mentioned it to you. It must be very painful to you. And John had missed a layup against the University of Richmond in the Southern Conference Tournament. If he'd made that layup, we would have beaten them and gone on to play West Virginia the next day. But John, who never missed layups, missed this one in the most important moment of his life as a basketball player. And Richmond went on to beat us in overtime by 2 points. And John looked at me and we went to the next light. He stopped. And John, not an emotional man, not a touchy-feely man like I am, looks over at me and he says, Conroy, I want you to know this. I did not miss that shot on purpose. I said, John, anybody that knows you knows that. He says, our coach didn't. I think Mel Thompson thinks I missed it on purpose to get him fired. And then John grabs me by the wrist and tells me, Conroy, I think missing that shot partially ruined my life. And Terry, words like that get my attention.
Really?
And I began going back, having no idea that year had touched anybody except me so completely, so totally, and so unforgettably. So this book is a result of that moment.
My guest is Pat Conroy. His new memoir is called My Losing Season. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We often talk to people with interesting personal stories that have larger social, cultural, or political resonance. Before we get back to Pat Conroy's life, let me tell you something about the continuing story of public radio. It's a familiar story, one you've heard before, but it's true and urgent and therefore needs to be repeated. Without your support, there's not enough money to broadcast the programs you enjoy. The fact that this is an old story doesn't make it any less true, so please call now with your pledge. Thank you for your support. My guest is Pat Conroy, the author of The Great Santini, The Prince of Tides, and Beach Music. His new book, My Losing Season, is a memoir about playing basketball for the Citadel, the military college in Charleston, South Carolina. Now, you played at a military college through your career, the Citadel. How do you think basketball at the Citadel compared with basketball at other schools in the league that you played?
The other schools were much better. There's a problem about playing in a military school as an athlete, and all athletes at all military schools, West Point, the Naval Academy included, athletes are not liked by the other cadets.
Yeah, you know, you say that in the book, and I couldn't figure out why, because, you know, in so many schools, the athletes are the heroes, or at least in certain circles, they're the heroes, and you say that they're second-class citizens in military schools.
But not in military schools. We are sometimes loathed because we get out of parade, we get out of inspection on Saturday morning, we get out of drills. Even though we're down there practicing 3 hours, the Corps never sees that, so they don't appreciate that. And, you know, one of the things that my teammates are still bitter about is they come across alumni who said, oh, you're an athlete. You didn't really go through the system.
Right. Now, what about the kind of basketball that you played at the Citadel? How did that compare with the kind of playing at the other schools that you competed with?
Well, Coach Thompson was very anal in his coaching. The offense that I ran when I was a freshman was the exact same offense I ran the last game I played at the Citadel. It never changed a bit. The defense I played was exactly the same. The out-of-bounds place was exactly the same. Everything we did was exactly the same. This was and it drove me crazy because the part about sports that I love is making it up as you go along, fast breaking. And all this was alien to Coach Thompson, and it brought him and I to, Coach Thompson did not like or enjoy the way I played the game, and it caused me a great deal of grief over the years. But when I quit listening to him, I did not care if he liked the way I played the game or not.
Were there teams you played with a more street approach to playing basketball that you were unprepared for?
This was the time in the South before integration. One thing that still I laugh about every time I see is a picture of my team. It's all white. And, of course, basketball now is a black game, a city game, an in-your-face game. And it's changed completely since I was down there. And when I was there at the Citadel, it was still in the South a white boys game. And that has changed completely. Now, what I loved was how the game was played in the ghetto. And I grew up following my father in Washington, D.C., and I learned to play with black kids. And I love to drive. I love to take it to the hoop. I love fast. I love behind-the-back passes, through-the-legs dribbling. And I was early to that game, Terry.
But you couldn't play that game at the Citadel?
Well, I played it after the New Orleans game, I started the rest of the season, and I found myself as a basketball player. My father and mother came to see me play my first college game. We played East Carolina. And all I remember from that game, I don't remember being at East Carolina. I don't remember a single thing about the game. I remember that after we lost, the manager came up to me and said, your dad's outside. He wants to see you. So still in my sweaty uniform, I walked outside, and I remember this part exactly. My father put his hand up on my chest, pushed me against a cinder block wall, and he said, and you have to translate this,
son, you're crap. Your team's crap. Your coach is crap. And you couldn't hold a candle to me on the best day of your life. I said, we didn't have a very good day, game, Dad. Can I go out and see Mom? Negative. We got to get back to D.C. My surprise, Terry, was when I went back to the game and looked at the box score. I discovered I had scored 25 points in that game, more than anybody on either team, and I was the smallest guy on the court.
You had a father who didn't know how to take pride in a son's accomplishments. He only knew how to be competitive with a son.
My father was simply overwhelming in that. I mean, I think I could have been an All-American. I could not have satisfied him. At the end of the year, I won two awards. I won the Sportsmanship Award, which I always won, no matter what the school I was at. My father hated it. He loathed it. And he said, the Chicken Award. My boy always wins the Chicken Award. But the other award was more difficult for my father. I won the Most Valuable Player Award of this team I wrote about. Now, me winning the Most Valuable Player Award on this team says much about the team and our fate. When I asked the players to rate the players by their skills as a basketball player, I ranked 11th of the 12 players. So the fact that I won the Most Valuable Player shows how much this team fell apart. And it seemed almost a mockery to me that I walked the world as the MVP of a team where we had so much better basketball players than I was.
Now, you know, the coach gave a quote about you to the local paper. Pat Conroy gave another great performance. That kid gets more mileage out of his talent than any player I have ever coached. Now, on the one hand, that's a great quote. He's saying you get more mileage out of your talent. On the other hand, I couldn't help but wonder, is he saying he gets more mileage out of a small talent?
That's exactly what it was. With Coach Thompson, when he gives you a compliment, there's always, another side to it.
Yeah.
And what he was saying is I was no good. But I overcame that somehow. And I knew what he was saying, but I still took it as one of the greatest compliments of my entire life. And I think later on in there, I tell my children, my heirs, I said, put that on my tombstone. Put what Mel Thompson said about me after my last game on my tombstone. That's what I want there.
Pat Conroy, his new memoir is called My Losing Season. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, more with Pat Conroy about his violent, authoritarian father and the second toughest man he's met, his basketball coach. His new memoir, My Losing Season, is about playing for the Bulldogs, the basketball team of the military college, the Citadel.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of A Fearsome Doubt, an Inspector Ian Rutledge mystery by Charles Todd, author of Watchers of Time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Pat Conroy. He wrote a fictionalized account of growing up with an abusive father in his novel The Great Santini. His novel The Lords of Discipline was based on his experiences at the military college The Citadel. His other books include The Prince of Tides and Beach Music. Conroy's new book, My Losing Season, is a memoir about playing basketball at the military college The Citadel. He describes his coach as the second toughest man he ever met, second only to his father. Would you describe your last game at the Citadel?
Yes. It was glorious. It was majestic. It was hard fought. Hard fought. I was guarding the great Johnny Motes, who led the Southern Conference in scoring that year. He was a much, much better basketball player than I was, and he proved it in this game. And he would come down court, Lord of that season. God, he was good. And I would hear pick right and pick left. And the whole Richmond team was trying to get him open. I'd have to fight over those picks. And Johnny Mote hit the most beautiful, glorious, high-arching jump shot you ever saw. He scored 39 points off me. He ate me alive. There was nothing I could do to stop him, but I tried. And my team, what I loved about my team was, even though we were in the middle of the season, they were lying hard. They fought hard. This team never quit. And even Coach Thompson, when I later went to visit him, said, none of my boys ever quit on me. And this is the highest praise you can get from a man like Mel Thompson. We came down. I was scoring well that year. I scored 25 points my last game also. It was my high, career high. But all game, I fought with Johnny Motes and screamed at Johnny Motes. And every time he came down, Motes and I went at each other. And then when I was on offense, I made Motes work. Okay, stop it. You can't stop me. Motes has a good chance you can't stop Oscar Robertson. Good chance you can't stop Jerry West if you go into the pros. We went into overtime. Now, I was going over these picks, and there was one guy on the other team named Green, who was a long, long, wonderfully built, but skinny kid. And his knee kept going into my left thigh every time I went over his pick. It was not dirty. It was good basketball. But over the game, it crippled me. In overtime, we called timeout. And on timeout, I went to John DeBross. I said, DeBross, you have got to take Johnny Motes for me. I can't walk. And he said, no, I'm not taking Motes. He's your man. I said, Johnny, your man hadn't scored this game. My man scored almost 40 points just taking this one time. And I'll take him in the next overtime. If we get into the next overtime, I'll get him again. So John DeBross gets on Motes, who comes up court. Motes exhausted, depleted. I was breathing as hard as I could. I was not guarding my man. I simply had my hands and my knees gasping for breath. And as he came up court, John DeBross, fresh, stole the ball from Johnny Motes. I saw him break. My job was to follow DeBross down court and to put it back in if he missed it. I didn't do that. I simply sat there with my hands on my knees, gasping. DeBross went down. As he later told me, Terry, he said, Conroy, the year had stunk. And I wasn't a fancy Dan like you, Conroy. I didn't like to please the crowd like you. I didn't go through my legs or behind my back. I was a good, solid basketball player. Normally, I would have just laid the ball off the basket, but I wanted to stick it in Motes's eye. I wanted to stick it in Richmond. I wanted to say goodbye to this horrible year. So I went, instead of going laying it off safely, I went straight in and finger rolled it off. And I did it beautifully, and I jumped high, and it all felt right. It all felt good. And then John DeBross says, and I remember being stunned when I saw it bounce. And I saw it bounce. I saw Motes get it. I saw Motes dribbling back. And then the buzzer ends, and we have lost. And Conroy, your career was over, and you wept in the locker room.
Yeah, you did weep. You're right about that. Was it embarrassing to be weeping in the locker room?
You know, it surprised me. You know, the Citadel is not a place to encourage weeping.
No.
It took me by great surprise. I just was sobbing uncontrollably. And I realized this game that I had started playing when I was 9 was over for me. It was just completely finished. I was not ready for it to be. And I did not realize the importance that the game was in my life. And I had no idea what I was going to do the rest of my life.
My guest is Pat Conroy. His new memoir is called My Losing Season. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Pat Conroy, the author of The Great Santini, The Prince of Tides, and Beach Music. His new book, My Losing Season, is a memoir about playing basketball for the Citadel, the military college in Charleston, South Carolina. In your new book, part of your story is about your father, who you've written about in other books as well, fictionalized, particularly in The Great Santini. And you write, "In my life as a writer, each day, I bring the ruined, terrorized boy I was as a child and set him trembling on my desk so I can study the wreckage of myself at leisure." Why, as a writer, do you want to keep returning to that terrorized boy that you were?
Because I cannot get that terrorized boy to leave me alone. He haunts me. In this book, I tell about my father as he was. I tell the story of my life with Dad. It always shocks me. The story always gets to me. Several years ago, Penn had a special thing at, Folger Library in Washington. And they asked writers to come up with their first memories. And I remember Eudora Welty, her first memory of sunshine on her face, and Reynolds Price, a goat, ate his diaper off him. And I remember all these wonderful, fabulous first memories. Then I get up and give mine. I am sitting there in a high chair in El Toro, California, and my mother is trying to stab my father with a butcher knife.
Hey.
And my father is laughing and is beating her to the floor as I am sitting there in my diapers watching this scene. And that was the first thing I remember. And that was Welcome to the World, Pat. And that was the world I inhabited until I was 21 years old.
Now, your father died in 1998 of colon cancer. What was it like for you watching The Great Santini, watching this really strong-willed, violent man who abused his family, watching him get really weak?
Well, it was heartbreaking. It was in the last months of his life. I was trying to think of a way to make it better for Dad, to make it easier for him as he was dying. So what I did was I interviewed Dad over his whole life. And I said I was writing a book called The Death of the Great Santini. And Dad said, "Great title, son. You know how to make someone feel really good." But Dad had changed when The Great Santini came out. There had been a sea change in my father. He was horrified by the portrait I had painted of him. And when he and I talked about it, I said, "Dad, I'm sorry I hurt your feelings, but there's nothing you can do to make up for my ruined childhood." But here's what Dad did. He became a good man. He became a good guy. All six of his children were still alive. We could not believe we were weeping at his funeral. Right before he died, and a couple of days before he died, he still was the same guy. I mean, he had not, you know, there was that basic core of Santini that never changed. My sister, the poet in New York, Carol, came down from New York, and we had shifts. His dad was dying in my sister Kathy's house. And I went over there one day, and I heard screaming from the outside. I'm half deaf now, Terry, so I don't hear screaming very often. So I heard screaming. I went in, and as I got closer and closer, it was Carol screaming at my father, "Dad, you've got to tell me you love me, Dad. You got to tell me you're proud of me before you die. You just have to, Dad." So I motioned to Carol to come into the next room, and I said, "Carol, that is Don Conroy dying in there. It is not Bill Cosby." And Carol said, he's never told me he loved me. He's never told me he's proud of me." I said, "He's never told me that either, Carol. But he sends you money every month, Carol. That's Dad. That's how he says I love you. He brags about you to me and your poetry. He always used to love this, Terry. He would brag. He'd always tell me, he says, you know, your sister is a much better writer than your son. I said, thanks, Dad. I appreciate it. And poetry is a much higher art form, son, than prose. Did you know that? I said, well, thank you very much, Dad. And I prefer your sister's poetry to your writing. She says in 5 words what you say in 5,000. I said, thank you very much, Dad. And I said, now, Dad, will you do me a favor? Would you name me one poem that Carol has ever written? And Dad just roared with laughter. But on this day, I was trying to tell Carol that Dad had different ways of saying he loved us. He couldn't tell us that directly. Anyway, I give this to you. Calm Carol down. We go back in, and Dad would be dead in 2 days. And as we go back in, my brother-in-law, Bobby Joe Harvey, who calls himself the family redneck, and for good reason calls himself the family redneck, and he lives up to the name. Bobby Joe is coming in to cut Dad's hair, cut his fingernails, doing something. And as Bobby Joe comes in, Carol and I are sitting in chairs around the room. And my father opens his eyes, sees Bobby Joe, and says, and I quote, Terry, "I love you, Bobby Joe. I'm proud of you, Bobby Joe." And Carol went off like a Roman candle. But that was the Santini's old humor and old malice at work to the very end.
Were you with him when he died?
My brother Mike and my brother Tim were with him when he died. And we were doing shifts on that too. And it was, I ended up writing a eulogy for Dad. And Carol read a poem at his funeral. And his funeral was something. And people came from everywhere. And CNN announced it on the evening news, which I loved.
Did he ever, like, really get the fact that you were wildly more successful than he ever was? You know, after all the years of him putting you down and telling you that your basketball game could never be as good as his and that you could never be a man like him and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Did he ever realize, I mean, really get how successful you were?
I don't know. You know, Dad, here's what Dad never became. Son, I'd like to have a talk with you heart to heart. You know, he never did anything like that with me. And I would have to interpret Dad. The thing that I treasure most about Dad and my career was after The Great Santini, a book he hated, but he loved the movie. And my father thinks he made Robert Duvall's career. He thinks he is fully responsible for Robert Duvall's career. But when The Great Santini came out, Dad, I remember coming to Rich's department store in Atlanta, and his feelings were still hurt. He was still brittle. His mother, my grandmother, never spoke to me again. And his family had gone nuts when the book came out. So I'm sitting there signing, and the next thing I knew, somebody had come up to my father and asked him to sign the book. So my father signed it. "I hope you enjoy my son's work of fiction," the underlined fiction, you know, 10 times. And he said, and he then signed it, "Old Lovable Likeable, The Great Santini." And it started something that became habitual in my father's life. Whenever I had an autographing, he would sit beside me, and he would autograph the book. And I think it's the only time in American history that a father and a son sat and signed books together. And, you know, what I loved about it is he would be saying, Dad was slower than I was. He was much more elaborate, and he was charming. His second half of his life, his charm came out, which I never saw once in the first half of his life. And he would sit schmoozing and talking and laughing and enjoying himself. And then he would look up, he'd look over, and he'd look over at me, and he says, "My line's longer, son."
You know, my theory is about people who are cruel and don't really comprehend the pain that they're delivering is that they have to be very, very delusional. I mean, often those people think, you know, I'm tough and that's a good thing and I'm toughening my son and someday he's going to be real grateful. And I'm beating my wife. Well, she deserved it and she'll come around too. Do you think your father was really delusional during those
years?
Let me
tell you how delusional he was, Terry. My mother left my father the day after he retired from the Marine Corps. We were all there, dun, 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 dun. There's Dad leaving the Corps. Mom leaves him the next day. I told him, I said, Dad, why don't you come up to Atlanta? And, you know, I hated him at this time. I hated him. He was hated by all seven of his kids. Hatred, pure and simple. But I felt sorry for him because he didn't know what to do without a uniform, without his milieu. So I said, just come up to Atlanta. You can stay with us a couple of days. He said, no, son, I belong here. Your mother will realize the error of her ways, and she will come back. I get to Atlanta. 2 hours later, Dad knocks on my door and says, son, could I take you out for a beer? Dad had never taken me out for a beer or anything else. So we went to Manuel's Tavern in Atlanta, and we order a beer. And I said, Dad, what's wrong? And my father shocked me by putting his head down on the table and sobbing, just sobbing. So Manuel came over, and I said, what's wrong, what's wrong? I said, Dad, he hates your beer, Manuel. He just doesn't like it. And I'll get him another one. No, he just doesn't like your beer. It's bad. Dad's sobbing, and everybody in the restaurant's, you know, looking. So I finally, you know, said, Dad, do you understand what you did wrong? And Dad said, yes. And I said, what is it, Dad? What did you do wrong? And my father said, I was too good. I didn't crack down hard enough. I was too easy on your mother and my children. And I was astonished with disbelief. I said, Dad, Caligula couldn't have cracked down any harder. Nero couldn't have cracked down. What are you talking about? He completely did not see it.
In the very beginning of your memoir, My Losing Season, you write, I grew up a complete stranger to myself. Once you became an adult, I think you've lived a life of very complete introspection, both through therapy and through writing, because so much of your writing has been autobiographical fiction. And I guess I'm wondering about going from that one extreme of being a complete stranger to yourself to the other extreme of this regimen of therapy and introspective writing.
You know, I don't know how that is going to end up. I was surprised when I went back into this childhood again. You know, it took me by surprise. But I realized I never told the whole truth about it. My father was extraordinarily hard on me and extraordinarily hard on his family. In turn, I have been extraordinarily harsh with myself. In this book, I think I was after a task. The one thing I've never done for myself is like myself very much. And I think I went back to this book because I needed to fall in love with a boy I once was. But as I was writing this book, I was going, what a boy. This kid's something. Here this kid is coming out of this ridiculous family. He wants to be a writer. He's a cadet. He's on the honor court. He takes everything seriously. He tries to be a good member of the Citadel community. And I started admiring the kid. I just started admiring him. I thought, you know, this kid's doing the best he can under arduous circumstances. And I think that was my task in this book. I needed to like myself for the first time.
Is this book a memoir instead of fiction because your father's dead?
Well, I think it is. I do not think I could have written it when Dad would. I found this out by accident when I wrote an introduction for a book called Military Brats by Mary Wirch. My father did not mind it as much when I called him Bull Meacham, or as he said, when I made him a shrimper in The Prince of Tides, or I made him a drunk judge in Beach Music. I said, Dad, you couldn't catch a shrimp in a Long John Silver's. Give me a break. But my father said something that I thought was great literary criticism. He said, son, you will never be able to write the word father without my image coming up. And the father will never be an easy word for you because my face will loom up. And my father's right. You know, father is a damaged word with me. When I wrote this thing for an introduction for Mary Wirch's book, it shocked me because I wrote the words that in my youth, I thought Don Conroy would one day kill me. And my father went berserk when I used his name. And he did not mind me using Bull Meacham or Great Santini because he could say that as fiction. But when I used the word Don Conroy, I was using his name and I was talking about him, and there was no place for him to run and hide when I, you know, just said who it was.
I think it's really lucky, probably, that that you feel your father changed as he got older and that you had a much more decent relationship. You had a good relationship with your children, so that you have another way of thinking of him and you're not continuing your life after his death with nothing but hatred in your heart for him.
Yes, I was lucky. I adored Dad when he died, and my father knew it. And I think I wrote The Great Santini. I think I've lived my life for this. I thought I wrote The Great Santini because I hated my father. And I realized later that I wrote it because I needed to love him. I needed a father to love. And I think it's a human need and a human wish. And I had it as strong as anybody. So I think I forced my father to become a good man and a good father.
Pat Conroy, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Pat Conroy's new memoir is called My Losing Season. This is Fresh Air. Well, I'm not the kind of authoritarian that Pat Conroy's father or coach was, so I'm just going to ask nice. Please, call with a pledge. Because, trust me, your station will broadcast Fresh Air only if you support it. Thank you for your support. For months, the White House has been talking about regime change in Iraq and how to achieve it. Our linguist, Jeff Nunberg, has been listening.
There's nothing so powerful as a slogan whose time has come. In 2001, there were a total of 9 mentions of the phrase regime change in major newspapers. Since January of this year, there have been more than 600. Yet there's nothing new about the notion of regime change itself. I found the phrase in political science articles from as far back as 1968, and the word regime has suggested impermanence ever since it first entered the English political lexicon just after the French Revolution. That was the mother of all regime changes, and it gave us the phrase ancien régime, or old regime, as a name for the form of government that was about to come to a decisive end. Regime has been used ever since then to refer to a country's form of government. In that use, it needn't be disparaging. People talk about democratic or parliamentary regimes as easily as about totalitarian regimes. But when we call a government a regime, there's usually a sense that its hold on power is insecure or unsteady, as if you could hear the tumbrils rolling in the distance. We talk about the democratic regimes of Latin America, but not about the democratic regimes of North America or Western Europe. Those we just call democracies. As best I can tell, the difference between a democratic regime and a democracy is that with the latter, you figure you don't have to keep checking in to see who's in charge. But regime has another, more recent use, where it refers to the particular people in power in a country rather than to its form of government. That's the sense that regime has when it's paired with the name of a ruler or a political party, like the Castro regime or the Sandinista regime. Or people sometimes talk about the Havana regime or the Beijing regime with the implication that the rulers just happen to be squatting in the seat of government. In those cases, regime always implies that the government is illegitimate or undemocratic. We don't talk about the Blair regime or the Ottawa regime or the Washington regime, and the only people who talk about the London regime are Irish nationalists referring to the Unionist government in Belfast, which sort of proves the point. You can get a sense of just how high a government ranks on the current public enemies list by seeing how likely the press is to describe it as a regime. When I did those counts on the names of current rulers, Saddam Hussein came in first, and second place was a tie between Castro and the Assads of Syria. Then came Gaddafi, the North Koreas, and the Iranians, with the Chinese and the Saudis trailing well behind. There's a clear tendency here for the press to use regime more for governments that the U.S. has particularly antagonistic relations with. The Castro government is more than twice as likely to be called a regime as the Beijing government is, and the Syrians are six times as likely to get the label as the Saudis or Musharraf is. Still, I can see the journalistic logic to this. The label regime implies impermanence, after all, and historically speaking, governments that have gotten on the wrong side of the U.S. haven't generally proved very stable. In the past, in fact, the press has used regime most frequently of leaders that the U.S. was actively trying to topple, like the Sandinistas, Noriega, Milosevic, and the Taliban. The only difference between then and now is that the phrase regime change seems to make that principle a matter of official policy. What makes regime change such an inspired slogan is the way it plays on the ambiguity of regime itself. Of course, everybody knows what the administration supporters have uppermost in their minds when they talk about regime change. Ari Fleischer made that quite clear when he said that regime change in Iraq could be accomplished for the cost of a single bullet. But in the language of diplomacy, regime change plays a lot better than a slogan like, "Let's take out this bozo." It suggests that what the U.S. is ultimately interested in is replacing the current Iraqi system with something more benign. Regime change. You have the picture of a country gleaming with all the appurtenances of a modern democracy. A League of Women Voters, Sunday Morning with Tim Russert, attack ads and hanging chads. Well, stranger things have happened in the last few decades. But regime change can be an unpredictable business, as liberals like Condorcet and Lafayette discovered at the time of that Ur regime change of 1789. In the first flush of revolutionary hope, they coined the phrase le nouveau régime to describe the new democratic order that they were building. But the phrase never caught on the way Ancien Régime did, probably because it was quickly overtaken by events. Over the following decades, the French went through a series of dictatorships, despotisms, monarchies, communes, and short-lived republics, throwing the whole region into a turmoil that it took 150 years to recover from. It wasn't until 80 years after the fall of the Bastille that the French finally stopped lurching from one regime to the next and settled into a more or less stable democratic system that nobody was tempted to describe as a regime in the first place. It turns out to be easier to get rid of regimes than to create a world where the word is unnecessary.
Jeff Nunberg is a fellow at the Stanford Humanities Center and the author of the book, The Way We Talk Now. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, former NBA star Charles Barkley. His new book is called I May Be Wrong, But I Doubt It. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.